Kiwanis Clubs held a joint meeting at the Commercial Club. Their guest speaker was Mr. Martin Middleton of Cody, Wyoming, a former member of the bar of the state of New York. Now KGHL presents in the public interest a delayed recording of the events at the Kiwanis meeting.
It gives me a good deal of pleasure today to have the opportunity to introduce to you a man whom I know I and all of us will enjoy listening to when I have returned to my chair after I make these few remarks. The speaker for today has behind him a distinguished career as a member of the bar of the state of New York. In the 30s, he was the district attorney for Nassau County, Long Island, New York, during which time he prosecuted many famous criminal cases, among them the Creighton Applegate poisoning case, which has become a classic example of criminal prosecution at its best. In the early 40s, Mr. Littleton forsook New York for the green pastures of Wyoming, where he now resides near Cody and ranches and practices law. He's long been interested in the cause of good government and is here today to present that cause to you. I take great pleasure in introducing to you Mr. Martin Littleton of Cody, Wyoming.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. President, Mayor of Billings, distinguished guests, gentlemen. It would seem that I am becoming somewhat of a fixture in Billings. The kindly hospitality and the warmth of the friendship that has been shown to me on previous occasions has led me into the dangerous course of coming back once again. It is advised that it is dangerous to carry the jug to the well too often. But the feeling that has been engendered in me on the previous occasions of my visit here prompts me to take the risk. I'm grateful for this opportunity, which makes, once again, my visit to Billings possible. These months of April and May are significantly conspicuous by reason of the many anniversaries which are commemorated within them, and of which I am afraid we, the American citizens, are a little indifferent about. It was on April the 18th, just 4 days from today, in 1775, that Paul Revere made his memorable ride to warn the people of Middlesex of the approach of the British. It was in that same period of time and within a few days shortly thereafter that the battles of Lexington and Concord were fought. And then came Ticonderoga with Ethan Allen and Bunker Hill. And into 1776, on that memorable day which we celebrate each year, July the 4th, when that small band of patriots representing the 13 colonial states mustered their courage against overwhelming odds and indicted that immortal document, the Declaration of Independence. Beset as they were by overwhelming odds of a massed British army, supplemented by thousands of mercenary Hessians who had been retained to increase and augment their forces, this courageous group indicted not only the cardinal principles of their declared and avowed freedoms, but in the same instrument they wrote one of the most blistering and scorning indictments in recorded history against the despotic monarch George III of Britain. They went on through the next 5 years fighting from behind the rocky rills of New England, penetrating deeply in the hitherto unexplored wilderness of the Northlands to take Montreal, suffer defeat in Quebec. With blood-stained tread, they came down through the frozen wastes and the windswept shores on Long Island. And Washington, at the head of his troops, were forced to retire from New York, leaving it to be burned by the enemy. Then came Burgoyne, Brandywine, the crossing of the Delaware amidst the ice floes, under terrible circumstances. That fateful winter at Valley Forge, when the patriots left their stained footprints in the crusted snow, gave mute testimony to the hardships that they suffered in order to cast from their shoulders the gall and oppressive yoke of dictatorship and slavery from a far and remote monarch. They were short of arms. They were not equipped as we know the modern soldier. They were short of food. They suffered the cold and the vicissitudes and hunger. But they had one thing that is essential to every man who is going to succeed and achieve. They had burning within them the kindled flame of the desire for liberty and freedom and the dignity of man. That took the place and equaled the odds of those forces leveled against them. And so they fought from the Northlands down into the depths of Savannah, Georgia, through the sandy hills of the Carolinas, on the coast of Delaware. And we remember the recorded fact of history in the Battle of Princeton and Trenton and Monmouth, New Jersey. And at long last and finally, on that great day of October the 19th, 1781, Cornwallis laid down his sword in surrender. Those patriots rose and lifted their heads from the burning wreckage and shattered debris of war. 13 small colonial states in a relative wilderness, and then set about to lay the foundations and develop the blueprint for a lasting and permanent government which would no longer brook or tolerate the usurpation of power by any man. On May the 14th, 1 month from this day, 1787, the first constitutional convention of the world assembled. The delegates from these same 13 colonial states met and elected George Washington the presiding officer. And then they gave themselves to the task of cementing together those 13 colonial states in a unified government which would not transgress upon their individual rights and liberties, nor trespass upon the rights and liberties of the states and the sovereign power which they intended to reserve into the states, but which government could unite and call them together in the times of national crisis and disaster and for the common defense. May the 14th, they set about this task, and it was accomplished by September of the same year and adopted by the delegates of that convention. In June of 1788, New Hampshire, the last ratifying state, the ninth state to ratify, finally approved this constitution, which at that time consisted of only seven articles, the Bill of Rights and the well-known Ten Amendments coming thereafter. And thus on that date it became the Constitution of the United States. It is well that we pause in these days not only once, but frequently, to rededicate ourselves not only to the written word as these masters of the pen have written it, but to the philosophies and the burning desires to preserve that freedom, as they say, for ourselves and our posterity, lest in the headlong plunge of this modern civilization and the remote and detached forces which we have set loose, we find ourselves someday beyond the purview of the work they so well did. The fear that these delegates had in developing this great instrument, the greatest ever struck from the pen and mind of man, was that they not set up a Frankenstein, which once it was given full control should consume them again. And they wrote it to guard against that. For instance, the first article of the Constitution creates the legislature, the Congress as we understand it. And with what infinite wisdom they devised the system for the legislature when they provided that it should be elected in the House of the Congress from the political subdivisions of the nation in accordance with demarcations of population. They provided for a Senate, two from each state. First, they were to be elected by the legislatures of the state. Subsequently, that was amended to allow them to be elected at large. Thus, they provided immediately in the very first article of that instrument the very means by which you and I, we the people of this nation, would have immediately within our control and power those whose hands were to guide our destinies in the halls of our legislature and to enact the laws and to promulgate the rules by which
our course of conduct was to be governed. It was the true embodiment of a government by the consent of the government and not at the will of a dictator. In that very Article 1 by which they created the legislature, it was provided further, as a subsequent amendment, Article 10, that the powers not expressly vested in the government by the terms of that Constitution were reserved to the people and to the states, who at all times were to be sovereign. Those wise men who evolved this process with still the wounds of war gaping and unhealed knew full well that once you let go the leash of control and vest power into any man or any group of men, how noble and lofty their words may be, that you came face to face in a conflict and a clash with the age-old weakness of a thing called human nature. And they weren't going to leave it upon the unpredictable vagaries of the human equation. They said, therefore, that those powers that were not expressly conveyed to the federal government by this Constitution were expressly reserved for the states. They wanted to keep the intimate control of the affairs of this nation within the hands of the people. They were sick of the reign of George III, who from the far-flung seas had controlled these colonies without ever having once seen them or set foot upon the shore. They didn't intend to create a monstrous Frankenstein which had a remote distance, inaccessible to the people, where they had no approach or no immediate contact, that it should ultimately and for the time eternal control and regulate the course of human life in this newfound nation. In the second article of this Constitution, they provided for a president of the United States as the executive officer. In sections of Article 1, they provided for his qualification in office, the means and method of his election, and the Electoral College, with which we are not now immediately concerned. They gave him the right and the power to veto acts of the legislature. But again, as a series of checks and balance, he could exercise that veto, but in another provision that was permitted to the legislature to repass the measure over the veto of the president by a two-thirds vote. Thus, as this thing develops, you see that it is a series of checks and balances, one upon the other, one against the other, whereby no one has the complete and final control of the situation. And then third, as a part of this tripod of government upon which all of our freedoms and liberties so tenuously rest, came the Supreme Court of the United States. How many times in the course of your busy lives or in your relaxed moments have you ever given the slightest thought of recent years to the Supreme Court of the United States? How often, if ever, have you ever figured it into the general mosaic and the pattern and needlework, if you please, of the background and the philosophy of this government? Let us give it a few minutes' thought. It is the most vital part of this trinity of government. The Supreme Court, now as it is composed of a Chief Justice and 8 Associate Justices, was designed and devised by these learned men for the purpose of passing final tests upon the enactment of the legislature. To see to it, if you please, that the enactment of the legislature, of your representatives and mine, measured four square with the written permission to legislate given by the Constitution which emanates from you and me, the people of this nation. The Supreme Court, therefore, has entrusted to its hands one of the most serious, one of the most powerful, and the most solemn obligations of anybody in this nation in the preservation of our freedoms and our liberties. And why? Well, take it this way. The legislature can enact. It can be vetoed by the president. It can be repassed by the legislature. They can enact anything. But it finally must come before that Supreme Court for ultimate determination and measurement and the testing of its standards to see if it fits four square within the corners of that Constitution. And if it doesn't, it is the duty of that Supreme Court to say, that the enactment is unconstitutional. That's a vast power. That is a tremendous power. And why it is so vital and important is because those nine men have the last and final say. There is no appeal once they have spoken. In a contested enactment, when it is brought for their consideration to test and measure, and they say it's constitutional, that is the end. Except in rare instances where time rolls by and the mischief, if there be mischief, has already been done, and a subsequent Supreme Court should reverse a prior decision. It happens, but it happens seldom. And as I say, the intervening time is sufficient to permit the mischief, if there be mischief, to be done. We saw it back in 1937 when the then President of the United States, because the Supreme Court as then composed, would not declare constitutional certain legislation. And I refer to the NRA with that ugly prune bird sitting upon the shoulder of everybody in these United States. And in the Schechter poultry case, the Supreme Court then composed, declared it unconstitutional as it was, and as everyone knew it was. And then followed what must be recorded if faithful facts and truth of history are ever written, the shameful suggestion that the Supreme Court of the United States be packed and the number increased to 15 justices in order to enable a chief executive of the nation to nominate to that court those who would do the bill and willing of the chief justice. We may bow our heads in shame at that period in the United States. It failed. It failed only by a narrow margin, but succeeding time in the age of judges has permitted it to be done. And now we find them reaching into the preamble of the Constitution and taking from the words of the preamble, which, as you all well know, starts, "We the people of the United States," in order to promote a perfect union, to establish justice, secure freedom, and so forth, and promote the general welfare. Promote the general welfare. That was in the preamble. Not in any of the articles, not in any of the subdivisions, but in the brief declaration of principle by which they enacted the Constitution. What those purposes were to be achieved by the Constitution itself. But you may say, how did we become a welfare state? How has all this tumultuous mass of socialized legislation been ratified by the Supreme Court? It has been made possible because the Supreme Court went outside of the Constitution and the articles written and reached into the declaration of purposes in the preamble, promote the general welfare, and held that that language meant that they could virtually do anything with respect to the socialization of this nation. It was the stultification of intelligence. It was the debauching of the philosophy and the intent of the Supreme Court. And it was done with a deliberate intent and designed to perpetuate the legislation called for and demanded. Now, if they can do that, words are not an exact science, gentlemen. Words cannot be put down like two and two and say they equal four. You may do mental gymnastics and linguistical torturing of language which may make one sentence look entirely different. Therefore, the very embodiment of those Supreme Court justices must be founded deeply with their roots firmly established in the cardinal principles and the tested and vindicated traditions by which this formula for the preservation of our liberties was first evolved. We can't play at chicanery. We cannot contort and twist language. Now, the second reason that was made possible is because, and I make so bold to say, the chief executive of the nation during the many recent years has been motivated in designating Supreme Court justices more by reason of political considerations and friendship than by any true worth of the nominees named. And I'll be specific. Chief Justice Fred Vinson, a politician, a lifetime politician, named by his political friend and crony, the President of the United States, as a resting place upon the Supreme Court, when we know that there are in our great federal judicial system many learned men who have made of the judiciary a career and who have developed through the years the sound philosophy and understanding of our Constitution and the complexities by which it sustains your liberties, if you please, and mine. You didn't see a learned hand of the Circuit Court of Appeals, an illustrious justice in the federal Constitution, ever suggested or nominated for the Supreme Court. You haven't seen Harold R. Medina, that famous jurist who now tried the 11 communists, indicated as a candidate or a nominee for the Supreme Court. Instead, you find the chief executive of the nation picking the men for this Supreme Court from amongst his close political cronies and friends or amongst the political field. And it is thus that we have Sherman Minton and Tom C. Clark, who didn't even make a good attorney general for the United States and who, if they ever investigate the department, might sit uncomfortably on the bench. Those are the last three designated to this vast and powerful and profound position in these United States, which I assure you, and I stand here and defy and challenge any contradiction to be successfully made, into their hands must ultimately come every act, every law by which it is sought to regulate your personal conduct and your lives and your liberties and mine. And when I know that that must be passed upon by 9 men, I want there sitting 9 men who are steeped in the tradition and the lore of this great nation and the great principles upon which it was founded. I want a rule of law, not a rule of men. I don't want 9 men sitting there substituting their political and personal beliefs and warping and woofing and twisting language around for the passing political expediency of the moment to satisfy one class, to please the labor, if you please, passing legislation which will enable labor a special privilege over anyone else, or enabling industry to have a special privilege. And all this tumultuous administration, legislation on those subjects have been passed by that Supreme Court and their predecessors. And they never were within the contemplation of the founders, because those wise and learned men knew that once you open the floodgate, you have divested yourself of control and delivered over to an omnipotent government all the power that is necessary to regulate the course of human conduct. We must watch our Supreme Court, which is seldom spoken of, let alone the Constitution. When have you last heard any subject ever discussed or a speech made upon the Constitution of the United States? Search your memories and answer the question to yourselves. When have you heard any speaker, good, bad, or indifferent, stand four square before a group of people during recent years and revitalize and reclaim the Constitution as the fundamental document of this nation? Instead, we've had the isms. We've had all the concerns of how we can dodge and defeat and avoid and circumvent the Constitution. We've had apologies made for it. And we've had promises made which were violent to its precepts. It is time that we got back into the groove, because if it continues with the methods that have been employed, we are going to find this thing slipping faster than you and I may have ever realized. And it is that we must give our attention and our consideration to the Supreme Court, because, gentlemen, once nominated, they are beyond our reach. We can't visit with them. Oh, they can visit with the president, which is unheard of. Felix Frankfurter, the one-man employment bureau. Fred M. Vincent, the personal advisor to the President of the United States and visits in Key West to guide his political destinies. Unheard of things. The Supreme Court lives and should live a monastic life. It should remain detached and apart from the legislative branch and the executive branch of the government because those are the parties most often appearing before them for decision. They should not be couched and cornered and consulting and advising with the contestants in the court. They are the strong leg of this tripod of government. And thus, to bring this quickly to a close, in the few minutes which challenge the proper description of the vastness of this thing, we see that these learned and wise men built the foundation of this government upon a tripod. The executive, the legislature, and the Supreme Court. If one of those legs collapsed, the whole thing must fall. One alone. And those legs should be strong and reinforced with integrity, with courage, common sense, and unselfish devotion to the principles and the causes which brought it about and made us, in spite of the cavailing and the criticism today, in a short 177 years, the greatest nation upon this earth, because by the very terms of that Constitution, the inventive genius, the spirit and the soul of man was set free for development of that which came to his hand. And within the short span of our existence, we have outstripped those venerable nations which have been civilized, so-called, for centuries upon centuries. You cannot stimulate the slave. You cannot have progress with serfs. It takes the free man with the hope of reward and return for his ventures and his risk to build a nation which we are proud to claim as our own. I thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, KGHL has brought you in the public interest a tape recording of a speech by Mr. Martin Littleton of Cody, Wyoming, made before a joint meeting of the Yellowstone and Billings Kiwanis Clubs today at noon in the Commercial Club here in Billings. This is Billings, KGHL.